ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Jules and Jez here, and every week on Not Stupid, we chat about the news in your feeds.
State and territory governments collected about $9 billion in gambling taxes in 2022-23.
That's a massive amount of money for states to unhook themselves.
It's a sugar hit that if you give that up.
But we haven't had that conversation.
No.
It's like, do we accept that social evil?
You can find Not Stupid on the ABC Listen app.
Today, the Australian people have voted for Australian values.
Government is always formed in the sense of the centre, but our Liberal Party reflects a range of views.
Politics is the brutal game of arithmetic, but no one's going to vote for you if you don't stand for something.
We've always been about the planet, but we've got to make sure that people have their daily needs met.
People are starting to see that there is actually a different way of doing politics.
Hello and welcome to The Party Room. I'm Patricia Carvelis, joining you from Wurundjeri country in Melbourne.
And I'm Fran Kelly on the Gadigal land of the Eora Nation here in Sydney. And PK, we're back. We just can't keep away. We've got another bonus question time edition of The Party Room because there was just so much happening when we recorded the Thursday edition that we just couldn't fit in the questions. And you all know we love your questions.
We do. And we get so many that it's actually a little unfair just to do ones. So sometimes this bonus episode situation, I think, works really well. Just though, before we get to the questions, just a bit of an update. There was the meeting at a location in a leafy suburb of Melbourne yesterday between Andrew Hastie and Angus Taylor and some other blokes. And I say blokes because it's been pointed out to me, well, I could see it myself, but from Liberal women, for instance, Fran, that isn't this an interesting optic, the sort of festival of men meeting together.
Unbelievable.
Pictures were not fantastic given they're about to roll a female leader, the first ever in the party's history. Okay, let's park that because, of course, whether Susan Lee's leadership is working goes way beyond gender, I think. But, you know, gender is always part of it, not the whole story. Fast forward, they have their meeting. No deal, my friends, no deal. So they have basically briefed out that it was a constructive conversation. Michael Suka, who lost his seat of Deakin in Melbourne, was a senior shadow minister under Peter Dutton, was kind of the broker of this meeting as a sort of liberal right figure, trying to get a deal. Because remember, for those of you who are not sort of across every detail, they're both essentially from the same faction. And so that means the faction split. This gives the moderates a real boost because if the right split, how do you get rid of the leader? You need some unity there to peel off some of the moderate numbers. So they have the meeting. They both essentially, I've been told, offer each other the deputy role, which is gold, right?
That was gold.
You can be my deputy. No, you can be my deputy. That's my kind of, if I could be a fly on the wall, but it's like, I love this. And I kind of get it as well, right? You got to understand from Angus Taylor's perspective, he's older, he's been around longer, he's done economic portfolio. He'd think, hang on a minute, it's kind of my turn. I ran last time, got really close. I can do this. You can be the deputy. You can try and get ready for the future sort of leadership role. And from Andrew Hastie's perspective, and can I say many of his colleagues I've spoken to, the party right now needs generational change. It needs a different sort of leader. He is a millennial. Why does that matter? Well, they've got a problem with younger voters. Now, I find the concept of youth in the coalition kind of funny because he's in his 40s. I'm in my 40s. I find it funny when anyone sort of thinks of us as youthful because we're not. But I get that it's not the same as Taylor or anyone older, or Susan Lee is even older than that in her 60s. So that's where it's at. Basically, they're stuck, Fran.
They are stuck. You've got two bulls in a paddock and they're ramming. They want to ram each other. They do not want to sort of walk along gently side by side holding hands. There's no way. So this has got a way to go. I think, you know, I know I keep saying it, but what does John Howard say? It's always about the arithmetic. It'll depend on who works the phones and gets the numbers. And, you know, Angus Taylor notably, I thought, said, look, now is not the time. Now is the time to settle and work out what the Nats are doing and try and unite the party. Is that him buying more time so he can work the phones? Because he was away on a holiday in Europe. The reports that I've read all suggest that Andrew Hastie has the edge on him in terms of numbers at the moment. But then again, so many of the Liberal Party room keep saying publicly, no one's rung me, no one's rung me. So I'm not sure how good the counting is going on. I thought it was interesting today that Senator Jane Hume, a Liberal, described, I think, as a moderate, conceded that this hasn't been the most edifying moment. She was not really impressed with that blokes meeting in Melbourne yesterday and the timing of it on the day of Katie Allen's funeral. And a lot of the women upset about that, particularly not just the optics of getting together a room full of blokes to roll the first female leader, but also the Liberals have a woman problem, right? That's what their post-mortems have been telling them for the last decade. And it's not a great look. And Jane Hume didn't think it was a good look. And, you know, that's from Jane Hume, who says now is not the time. And she has not been a fan of Susan Lee publicly. She was dumped by Susan Lee. She was angry about that. She made that clear. And just this week, she made comments that suggested Susan Lee hasn't been able to get the support of the people. So I thought that was interesting.
Yeah, it's very interesting. Look, I think that we are in really tricky territory right now. Without a deal, it looks like it'll be very hard for a spill to happen next week, a spill being, you know, the motion that you push for a majority to say, yes, we want to open up the leadership, just to explain the language. But I've spoken to some right-wingers who say, okay, regardless of if the numbers are there or not, like there is genuinely now, it's wild. How do you continue like this when these
They sit in the chamber on Monday or Tuesday? Yeah. I think it's a Monday. How do they do that? Because they don't have shadow ministers to ask questions. Half of them are the Nats and they're gone. And Susan Lee's going to have to work out something. They keep saying, you know, they'll be acting ministers because, you know, human beings are human beings. And if you give someone a job, a Liberal Party member a job and say, okay, you're now the shadow trade minister, which means you get a bit more staff and a bit more money and all of that. And then the coalition gets back together again, which they're going to have to do if they have any hope of winning government again. That person might lose their job to the Nats. You're going to have a lot of really pissed off people.
You're going to have a lot of pissed off people. Best line ever from Fran Kelly. You're going to have a lot of pissed off people. Anyway, we don't know what will happen next week. People who tell you that they know are lying because no one knows. The people themselves don't know. The contenders don't even know. But I think it's going to be quite wild. And strap in, folks. We'll bring you all the updates. That's our job here on Politics Now in the Party Room. Fran, I need to ask you what you make of the actual work of the government. Don't worry, we know there's a government. We know it's got some work to do. National Cabinet is meeting today to discuss hospital funding agreement with the states. The PM's message this week has been, I'm not an ATM. This is a phrase my partner uses with the children as well. So when I heard it, I was like, that's Pete's line. Shout out to her. Like, you know, this is not an ATM situation. What does he mean? What's he talking about?
I'm pretty sure I've heard this before. It's classic, right? Classic Commonwealth, state, federal relations. What did Paul Keating say? Never get between a premier and a bucket of money. National Cabinet comes together. That's where the state and territory leaders meet in a room or by Zoom. This time they're all in Sydney together. They're often not together, so this is a big effort, and it's a big effort because there's a lot of money at stake. This is something called the National Health Agreement, the Commonwealth Health Agreement. It's a three-year agreement. It's due to expire in June, at the end of June. It's where the government transfers an awful lot of money to the states so they can fund their hospitals and their public health systems and all of that. And this time there's a big realignment going on because more has to be spent on the NDIS, and there's a realignment of how the NDIS is going to work. And the government wants the states to, you know, do their end because they've got to manage the services and pay for those services. So the government's got $23 billion more on the table. Sounds like a lot of money. The state said, that ain't enough. It's not enough. If you want us to do all this new work with the NDIS in our schools and other places. So this is it's a really serious fight. It's not just posturing, I don't think. The change that is at the heart of some of this, not all of it. Aged care is also an issue. Thriving Kids program is about changing the services and where and what sort of services kids can get access to and who's paying for it. And the states, you know, need to stump up more. They always do. Every time, I've been covering politics for decades, every time the Commonwealth puts in more money, you find out later the states have eked a bit of theirs back out to spend somewhere else. So there's always that dynamic. There's no trust between the two of them when it comes to health funding, I don't think. Though I thought the Federal Minister Mark Butler was sounding pretty conciliatory. They need to get this done.
Now, they've come back and said they'd like it a little bit later, and I'm really just talking several months more than anything significant, and we'll engage with them constructively about that. But I think
they need to get this done this week because South Australia goes into caretaker mode for an election soon, and 23 bills on the table. My prediction is there'll be a few more billion thrown in, not as much as the states want, and everyone will go home and say, well, okay.
Okay.
Something like that.
Oh, you're on fire today. It's time for question time. Come on. It's the reason for this podcast.
Yeah, let's get to it. Come on.
Questions without notice. Are there any questions?
Members on my right.
Prime Minister has the call.
Thanks very much, Mr. Speaker. Well,
then I give the call to the Honourable, the Leader of the Opposition.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. My question is to the Prime Minister.
The bells are ringing. That means it's time for question time. Our first question comes from Zach.
Hi, Party Room. I'm Zach, calling in from the electorate of Maranoa. After the 2025 election, when the Liberal leadership was up for grabs, Andrew Hastie ruled himself out by saying timing in politics is everything, and that he wanted to spend more time with his family. If he now has genuine leadership ambitions just 8 months later, how should voters interpret that change? Does it undermine the credibility of his earlier explanation? And do these comments still affect how colleagues in the public assess his suitability for leadership?
Zach, very good question. I did a Four Corners right after the election called Decimated. That was very much, you know, had lots of people in it, but I think fair to say Andrew Hastie was a big character in it. And he essentially said, you know, it's not the right time for him because of his family, not to be leader. Now, on this question of family, I think people do mean it. But I often, you know, my most said term, like column A, column B, it's part of the story. It's not the whole story. Timing in politics is everything, he also said. I think he made a very clear decision that he didn't think he was ready at the time. He wanted an economic portfolio. He didn't end up getting one, actually, but he wanted one to sort of broaden himself out first. Also, he knew that after such a smashed up election, like they did so badly, that the first leader after the election was going to absolutely have the worst of it. And I don't think he wanted to be in that cycle. That's my analysis. And I think now he's hungry for it.
Yeah, I think that's true. I think that in terms of, you know, want to spend more time with my family, again, it's something we hear a lot. And I agree with you, PK. Sometimes it's mostly true, but it's usually not the whole story. But for politicians based in Western Australia, as Andrew Hastie is, I think they have an extra degree of that because travelling over from the West, having a leader in the West, is very demanding on families. But the timing in politics is everything. You're right. That wasn't the right timing. It wasn't the right timing because it's never great being the leader mopping up after such a shellacking. That's one thing. It's also not great being a young male when the other contender is a female. And as we've said before, the Libs have a women's problem. I think that was the optics of it wasn't right. But now, you know, timing is everything. And here's a chance. It's come to a chance. Susan Lee has not impressed some of her colleagues, but for a long time there's been speculation about her leadership. It's come to this point now where people are actively, you know, talking to the colleagues, looking at numbers, having meetings. The other contenders are meeting, so it's on, and he just doesn't want to miss that chance because, you know, you can let one leader go after a shellacking, but then I think the next time around you got to be prepared to step up, even if you and your family aren't quite ready. I think that's his thinking.
Yeah, I think so. I spoke to actually, you know, one of the people who supports him the other day off the record, but like I can share this. I actually said, I don't get it. Why would you, because I'm always intrigued by decisions, right? Like sort of when I talk on background, just giving you a sense. I said, why would you burn him now, right? Like he is quite young. He's clearly a future leader, has to develop himself. Why would you burn him now? when, let's be honest, the next election, it's really hard for them to go forward. Like, what's the point? And this person said, you know what, that has been in our consideration, because of course, but, and it's to your point, Fran, if you don't seize it, and I kind of respect that, what are you doing? You know, you can't die wondering. And he wants to do something very different with the Liberal Party, right? That's, you know, a lot is being made of his very conservative capital C elements, the immigration stuff, the net zero. But the thing that's not made of enough in my perspective about Andrew Hastie is he might be quite a game changer on some of the sort of younger politics, intergenerational stuff. Like, you know, he wants to think about appealing to that group, and on that might be a bit of a game changer, not a traditionalist like a Angus Taylor. So that's kind of also what they're thinking.
Yeah. No, and just on that, I mean, he is very conservative, and that's not going to speak to a lot of younger voters. Some of his positions on some of the cultural issues and also the lack of economic experience is an issue, I think, because as we were saying yesterday on the podcast, the big problem for the Libs at the moment is cost of living is what's concerning Australian voters at the moment. And the Liberal Party doesn't seem to be anywhere much close to genuine, developed economic policy that's going to make a difference. So that's going to be a challenge for him, but I guess that depends who his team is. In terms of, Zach, your comment about, you know, does it undermine his credibility with his colleagues? I don't think so. Or the public, I mean, the public won't remember. And his colleagues, well, it's, you know, the time is now. I think most people see that.
Let's see if the timing works out for him. And our next question comes from Dom.
Hi, guys. The question is, if the Liberal and National parties were to stay split, when would they have to start to select candidates to run in the new electorates for the 2028 election?
Terrific question, Dom. And who better to answer it? Not PK and I. In this case, our ABC Chief Elections Analyst, Casey Briggs.
Hey, Dom. Hey, Fran. Hey, PK. It's Casey Briggs here. Dom, great question. In some respects, there's a really easy answer to it, which is that parties don't actually have to select all their candidates until the nomination deadline, and that's just a few weeks before the election. For example, in South Australia, there's an election in less than 2 months, and no major party has announced candidates in every single seat there yet. But of course, the earlier a candidate is selected, the more time they have to run a campaign. So I think it's less here about what's required and more about what's politically smart. And practically, there's a lot the parties would have to do before they even get to the point of announcing candidates. I'll just give you one example. What do they do in Queensland? The parties have merged into a single entity there, the Liberal National Party. Does the state party split as well? I don't think they'd be keen on that because they're currently in government in Queensland. But if the party doesn't split, you'll have a Liberal brand and a National brand running at the federal level and a Liberal National brand running at the state level with an election at both levels expected in 2028. It might get pretty confusing for voters. So look, at the end of the day, everything's technically reversible up to the point that nominations are lodged. But the longer the divorce goes, the more the parties develop their independence, the more conscious uncoupling is done, the more complicated it gets.
You gotta love Casey. Conscious uncoupling.
Love it.
Like get them into a therapist. Let's get them fleeced talking about their inner child and how they've developed these issues. Look, I got to say, I totally agree with Casey because he's absolutely accurate, you know, and the longer it goes, the bigger issues there are. And that's why you've seen so much fancy footwork going on in terms of, you know, trying to kind of stare each other down in many ways. Now, because Casey answered that, it makes perfect sense for me to tell you that Casey is also joining us for our live party room in just a few weeks at Fair Day in Sydney, and our Fair Day is part of the Mardi Gras Festival, isn't it, Fran?
It is, and Casey's a fabulous guest, and right at this moment, well, let's see how this detente or breakup is going, but, you know, Casey's going to have all the answers. So that's going to be fabulous, Casey with us at Fair Day in Sydney on February the 15th. It's a Sunday. It's free. If you're anywhere nearby, we would love to see you. And can I just add to what you and Casey have said just briefly, the other issue, of course, about the split is funding, because elections cost a lot of money. So if they are running separately and not in coalition, which means they've got all these three-corner contests where the Libs and the Nats are running against each other, plus Labor and whomever else, it means they're going to raise a whole lot more money. The further you are from being in any kind of position to win an election, and if they're still separated, they're not going to be in a winning position, the harder it is to raise money, right? So that's going to be truer than ever. They'll have less money coming into their coffers, and then they'll have more races to fund between them. So it's going to be a real issue.
Yeah, I agree.
And they know it.
Oh, they certainly do. That's why you will see a resolution, my friends. Nothing like self-interest. Okay, next question comes from Greg. It's handwritten, so I'll read it. Hi, Fran and PK. With One Nation rapidly climbing the opinion polls, can you help me understand what your average voter sees in them? I find Pauline Hanson incapable of constructing a sentence, let alone one that makes any sense, and that her actions in Parliament have always tended to disadvantage the people who actually support her. Can you help me? Love to you both. Greg from Bris Vegas. Fran?
Well, Greg, yep, you might find her incapable of constructing a sentence. A lot of Australians feel like she speaks like them. And yeah,
she's relatable.
Yeah, she's relatable. You know what they also like? That she sticks it up to the major parties, that, you know, she pokes fun at the Parliament. So a lot of people think what you might see as, you know, some of her actions being in Parliament being untenable, like wearing the burqa. Others think, ah, she's having a razz, you know? And so there's that. But at that point, those people aren't necessarily thinking of electing her to Parliament. But the other thing is there's a whole lot of disenchantment. This is nothing new, okay? This has been happening for a long time. Mistrust of politicians, mistrust of mainstream media, mistrust of big corporations, disenchantment, feeling like others are getting all the breaks and you're the one missing out. Cost of living is a huge issue for people. And, you know, a lot of people, according to the polls, feel like the government isn't listening to them, isn't tapping into what they need. And so they're, can I say it again? Pissed off. And so when the electorate is angry and feeling they're not being heard and people aren't concerned about them, they're only concerned about themselves, and politicians bickering amongst themselves really brings that home, you know, then they want to just lodge a protest vote to some degree. And there's a lot of that going on, I think. Is that how you think, see it, PK?
Yeah, I think so. The part of the question I want to answer is, can you help me understand what your average voter sees in them, like One Nation more broadly? I think we cannot divorce the rise of the right around the world from the rise of One Nation. And so when I went to Pauline Hanson's press conference right after that news poll where they, for the first time in history, had gone, you know, they were basically polling higher than a main party, the coalition, first time, wild, right? It's just an opinion poll, but wild. It hasn't happened. One of the points she made is, I was doing this before Farage, I was doing this before Trump. And I've got to say, I nodded and I thought, well, I suppose you're right, actually. You kind of were. And so what do people see in her? Well, the reason they find those politicians appealing, she was already doing. And so she's kind of captured the political zeitgeist, at least on that side at this stage. And she has longevity. And don't forget that longevity does matter. She's got staying power and she's now made it an asset. So I think that's partly what's happened. And, of course, all the points you make, Fran. People disenfranchised, people require the cranky, she's a plain speaker, she's kind of seizes on people's annoyance at what they consider to be, look at that song, the Holly Valance song, like, you know, a woke culture that they think is out of step with Australia. She's very much aligned herself with some of the sort of anti-immigration nationalist fervour that's going on in the community. And the problem that the Nationals and also the Liberals are having is they will never, never out Pauline Hanson, Pauline Hanson. So, you know, she's always going, think about, I'll give you a good example, net zero. They finally won the argument to withdraw from net zero, the right wingers, right? Which they think will appeal in places where Pauline Hanson appeals more. But they still, because of the other flank, the moderates, couldn't get a withdrawal from Paris altogether. Guess what Pauline Hanson can do? She can just be totally against every international agreement, whereas the coalition, or at least the Liberals as a party of government, still have to dance with the international architecture, right? They still have to kind of, you know, they can't sort of say we're going to withdraw from every UN committee or every, like, that's not how they, because they're a party of government. So she can always appeal to that idea of that anti-internationalist, that anti kind of, you know, the conspiracy theory that it's this big global movement that's controlling us all. She's always able to do that. And right now that's gaining traction.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, as you say, she has longevity. She's been treated, I think people think, unfairly sometimes. She served some time in prison. You know, remember she was a single mum who used to run a fish and chip shop. That appeals to people that she's hung in there and she's made her way through the system. And as PK said, she hasn't had to, she's had the luxury of not having to develop economic policies that will work. So she can offer tax breaks for people that make no sense and would not work federally, but it's very popular because people feel like she gets them. And you know, we have been here before in a sense, not the polling federally so much, but don't forget that I think it was the 98 state election in Queensland, PK, I think it was, or back then in the 90s, One Nation surprised everyone, shocked everyone, changed attitudes within the Liberal Party and John Howard, importantly, by winning a swag of seats. I think it might have been as many as 11. It was certainly a lot of seats. And that really set people back on their heels. And since then, she's been taken much more seriously.
Yeah, she certainly has. Actually, Anthony Green joined me for a special episode on One Nation. It's been one of our most popular episodes. Obviously, Anthony Green, bit of a showstopper, that guy. Also, this theme, people are really interested in what's happening, and so you should be, because it's really fascinating and has huge implications. He sat down with me and spoke to me about sort of the history of One Nation, you know, their high watermark. They haven't actually been able to translate some of their results into electoral results in the past, whether he thinks that's changing, all of that. So that's in the Politics Now feed. We'll link that in the show notes.
I don't know how I missed that over summer. I'm going to go and listen to it this afternoon. I've got a long drive ahead. Yeah, I can't wait.
It's actually a really good episode. I mean, Anthony's great. Like, he just explains everything. So I really enjoy these episodes. And can I say, shout out to my daughter, Stella, who read every question to me on our drive to school, her first day at school back today. I was like, read them out to me. And she put on special voices for you all as well.
Oh, radio voice.
Yes. And she did a fantastic job. So thanks, Stella Bell. You can keep sending your questions to thepartyroom@abc.net.au.
Yeah, Stella, that's what all of us need. Yes, and remember, follow the Politics Now feed. That's the feed you'll find this Party Room podcast on the ABC Listen app, so you never miss an episode.
That's it for the Party Room this week.
But, PK, you're going to be back on Saturday. Incredible. With a special episode of Politics Now with Claudia Long, digging right into where Australia is at on ending violence against women, something the federal government promised to do in a decade. I wonder how we're going. Look forward to that.
I wonder how we're going. Yeah, it's a bleak topic, but I think it's a really important one. So we picked the brain of Claudia, and it's worth listening to. See you, Fran.
See you, PK.